Thanks for having me. And good morning to everybody. I think it's roughly around 11 a.m. It's still good morning. I wanted to talk to you guys about some joint work I did with Gian Okai and Aziz Karouf at over at Bildkent, and it's about just a different framework for approaching contextuality. I'll just get into it. One second. Here we go. There's a very like canonical paper from 93 by Merman, where he sort of outlines the contours of different kinds or different notions of contextuality. You had non-locality due to Bell. Sorry, I'm gonna please admit me this artistic license for the intro. I know that many people here already know this, but I will just sort of pretend that you don't. There's this paper, and so he sort of talks about, okay, you have this Koch and Specker version of contextuality, and then you have Bell non-locality. And he starts to sort of weave together the ways in which these things are related. And so that sort of brings about the question of like, okay, so these things are sort of different facets, so to speak, of maybe the same phenomenon that we'll just generally called contextuality. So you have Bell, sorry, the Bell sort of non-locality on one side, and then Koch and Specker. So we have the Merman square here, which is a classical demonstration of chaos contextuality. And so you might be interested in just determining, having a sort of nice framework for being able to handle these two different concepts together. So, over the past few years, there's been a variety of different approaches. There's the operational approach from Rob, and then there's the graph theoretic approach of Cabello, Cerevini, and Winters, I believe. And then there's the combinatorial approach. I hope I'm not missing any other approaches, but then there's the combinatorial approach of Achin, Fritz, Leverrier, and Anna Bellin-Sains. And then there's also the sheaf theoretic approach of Abramsky and Brandenburger. And also there's this cohomological approach due to Gian Okai and Robert Rausendorf, and I'm gonna blank. But so these are the sort of like basic contours of some of the approaches that have come in the past 10, 15 years. And I want to sort of focus on, I hope you guys can see my cursor, the last two of these, the sheaf theoretic and cohomological approaches, because the simplicial approach that I'm going to sort of talk about today, in some sense, it subsumes these two. So the basic idea before we get into the details is that it's based on these theory of simplicial sets. So as a physicist, this is not something that you typically are accustomed to working with, but in some sense, it sort of generalizes the idea of a simplicial complex. And in some sense, also, if you're a topologist, these are very nice objects to work with. If you're a physicist, you usually have, up until this framework, maybe not that common to work with simplicial sets. The basic idea is that measurement scenarios are mapped over to topological spaces. Measurement statistics get mapped over to simplicial distributions. And the cohomological and sheaf approaches can be sort of subsumed into this simplicial framework. As for the connection to the other frameworks, I think that they're a little bit different, so I don't know off the top of my head. I know that there was one paper I saw by Linda Wester, perhaps, trying to connect the sheaf approach to the operational approach, but I don't know how robust that connection is. So generally, I just want to sort of motivate the topic of today and then sort of get into the details of what a simplicial scenario is, how you define contextuality, non-locality. I want to apply the framework. So in the simplest sort of scenario, so the CHSH or Clauser-Horn-Shimoni-Holt scenario, and then also just talk about how you can also include quantum scenarios as well. So the cohomological approach, so I just want to linger on this for a second. The idea is the following. You have the classical Merman square, which is an instance of KS contextuality. And so in the cohomological approach, what you do is you take observables, quantum observables, and then you map those to edges in a chain complex. And then for all sets of commuting observables, like the rows or the columns of the Merman square, you assemble them into a face of this complex. And so, you know, with the classical example of contextuality for the Merman square, when you multiply everything together, you either get identity or minus identity. So the sign of that product is going to be mapped to some function beta. And beta is going to be a function from your faces, the faces of your space, to Z2 or ZD in general. So it's much more general than just the Merman square is this cohomological approach. But so for just giving the example, it suffices to just consider Z2. And when you actually assemble the Merman square into a topological space, you get a torus. And what happens is that you can witness contextuality by a non-trivial cohomology class. Okay, let me unpack that for a second. So as physicists, we're usually very, my first encounter with cohomology was through Dirac cohomology in manifold theory and sort of general relativity and stuff like that. And in that context, no pun intended, you have that a closed form, for example, is always exact, if and only if the space is like simply connected or something like this. So the set of closed forms forms a cohomology class. And if they can't be written as being exact, then you know that there is like a hole in your space. So in a similar sort of idea, you can actually have that when this beta function is non-zero, this forms a cohomology class, such that you can witness state-independent contextuality. I see a hand is raised.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but I just want to get clear on the status of the beta function. So like normally we would talk about assigning values on the left-hand side to you know, the nodes like XX, mm-hmm. ZZ, and YY, such that their products, let's say these are plus or minus one values, such that their, you know, products come out right. And so mm-hmm. I would have expected you to be talking about value assignments to the edges of your graph on the right and the faces, where the faces are like the constraints on the product. And
Absolutely. Actually, you're 100% right. So I hope I didn't cut you off. Yeah, so that's exactly right. So the definition, I have an extra slide somewhere in the back of my program here. So we can look at that later. But the idea is exactly like you said, you assign a value assignment S that goes from the edges to Z2. And then precisely like you said, you have a non-contextual value assignment if and only if beta is equal to, so beta is going to be a 2 cocycle in the technical lingo. And it's non-contextual if and only if it's equal to the boundary operator times S. So that's kind of like whether a differential form is closed or and exact. So if it's equal to DS, so take S to be the not the value assignment. So if beta equals DS, then it's then everything is non-contextual. But if beta is not equal to DS, then you have state independent contextuality.
Okay, and so one final question. You're imposing that the function that maps each edge to a element of Z2 Like, you're not allowing contextuality in the sense that, like, the XX operator cannot be assigned different values depending on whether I think of it as part of one face or another face. You really want to assign it a unique value, and then you're really just checking whether all there's any choice of values that satisfy these constraints, which, you know, in the Merman square would be getting the right products. And in your case,
So what you essentially do the same thing. It's the exact same contextuality proof as Merman. Basically, like you said, you can assign a value to each of the to each edge. You can assign a value, and then basically in each face, you have to have that these values satisfy some constraints owing to beta. And then what happens is if you sum them all up, this is how you get the value of beta for the entire space. And if this value of beta is non-zero, then you have state independent contextuality.
Okay, I think I get the flavor of it now. Thanks.
Can I also ask just clarification on how you're associating like the nodes in Merman's proof to edges, essentially, in the topological proof? It seems to me that you're saying every observable, which could appear in multiple contexts, mm-hmm. is associated with an edge, and every context then is a face, right? And so I was thinking, like, what if we had more than three observables to a context?
You can have volumes.
Right? So then you could have volume, and then you'd say, so, and if we had four observables in a context, then instead of having triangles, we'd have tetrahedrons would be the contexts, and each observable would no longer be associated with an edge, but be associated with a triangle, right? Like of the tetrahedron, a face of the tetrahedron, a 2D thing. But then where it seems hard for me is, well, what if an observable appears in one context, which is of four things, but appears in a different context, which only has two things, right? Like, does it have to be the case that every context where an observable appears has the same number of total observables? What do I do if, you know, XX appears with these three over here, but with only those two over there? Then I'd say, like, well, this one suggests that I should think of it as a triangle, but this one suggests that I should think of it as a line.
So the way that it works is that if you can, so it doesn't have to, so in this framework, it doesn't have to actually be triangles per se. It can be, this could be a cell complex. So when you go to the simplicial approach, it really does have to be triangles, and you have to triangulate the space. So that's somewhat of a constraint in that respect. But for example, the Merman star example, which I don't have pictured here, is given by quadrilaterals. So it's like you have, for example, instead, okay, so we know the context of the Merman star. So each of them have four observables in each row or column or diagonal. And so you can have a quadrilateral or a cell with four faces, and they all commute. And so there's more flexibility than just, there's more flexibility here than just you have to build up. So if you have additional observables that commute, in principle, you could also just have them be part of the face. Like the Merman star, for example.
I don't know if I have achieved full clarity, but I don't want to interrupt you at this point. So if I don't figure it out, I will come back to it.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Maybe I have a picture of it somewhere else. Yeah, you can also assemble that into a topological space. And in that case, like you said, there's more than one observable that's, it's more than just three observables. So it's not a triangle, it's something else. Your question is like, if I have XX that's in one context here, and then it's in two other contexts, I think you're looking for like, if it's not a uniform sort of distribution of context in some sense, like if XX appears in some weird way in many different contexts, didn't quite get the question, but we can talk about it.
Just a quick clarification. I'm sorry, I missed what the definition of beta was.
So I opted for a more like informal, but maybe this was precise definition, but beta is defined precisely through the product of all the operators in a particular row or column at the operator level. And so If you get positive identity, for example, in the top row, then beta is equal to zero. And if you get minus the identity, for example, in the last column, then beta is equal to one. And so beta is defined as a function from those faces to Z2 in a way that actually replicates the observables for quantum mechanics.
Okay, and that red arrow there, is that's pointing from the face, not from the edge.
Yeah, it's supposed to be from the face.
Okay.
The red face there is the only one with beta equals to one. So when you sum up the betas for all of these faces, you get a total of beta equals one, which witnesses a non-trivial cohomology class.
Okay, thank you.
So another, I think this is not a good question, but you can answer it quickly. Do I really need all of the context? Like, what if I just had the single context XX, ZZ, YY? So then the only thing that I would have is just this red triangle. It wouldn't actually form a torus. It wouldn't form a 3D object. It doesn't stitch together. It's just a triangle. And yet it has beta equal one. Does that mean there's contextuality?
That's actually a good question. No, it should not capture. By the way, this is a witness. It only goes in one direction, but that's not. No, actually, that's a good point. I'll have to think about that for a second. I didn't consider this example. It should not be contextual, right? Because it's just one. There's no contradiction that shows up. So I agree that that's not correct. I don't think that there's something wrong here. I have to think about why that's what evades that particular critique. Yes. Okay. I'll have to think about that.
I mean, my instinct was it would be something like you should be able to like start at one point on your surface and then travel around the world coming back to where you are. And you can't do that if the surface doesn't like bend around like as a sphere or a torus. Right?
By the way, this space, so I have it, you can define it more formally. There's only one vertex. So almost all of these are going to be closed spaces. So if you just have a single context, is it possible to close up the space? And I don't think it may not be. No, I think it's possible. Okay. I'm not sure. That's a very good example. I'll think about that for a second. Okay. Nonetheless, I mean, you can capture state-independent contextuality in this way. And you can also capture state-dependent through a particular process. So here you have to pick a quantum state. Say we pick the Bell state in this scenario because we're dealing with the Merman square. And so what you do is you assign, so all the blue triangles, by the way, have beta equals zero already. And the way that this one works is that you just sort of, what you want to do is you want to contract. So you take the context. So this red, what was previously the red context is the set of stabilizers for this eigenstate psi here. So these are its eigenvalues, 0, 0, 1. I'm looking at the exponentials of negative 1. So what you can do is you want to take out that context, and then you want to assign those numbers to the adjacent faces. So this 0 goes to this context, this 1 goes to the downstairs one, and then this 0 also goes here. And then you want to close that space up and then look at the resulting space that follows from that. So when you just take away, when you sort of close up that white hole, then you get the space that's on the right. And then you can do the same exact thing that we did before, where you sum up all of the beta values. So you define a new set of betas for each of these faces that comes from the eigenvalues, and then you can apply the previous construction for capturing contextuality, and you can see here that this one will, for example, get you something that's beta non-zero. So again, as we expect, we kind of have the state-dependent contextuality proof. Okay, so what are the downsides of this? So you can capture some certain kinds of contextuality proofs, parity, and also symmetry-based proofs, which I didn't really go in, but they're actually important if you want to analyze contextuality as a resource for like measurement-based quantum computation. This symmetry turns out to be, the symmetry-based proofs are also important. But the basic idea is that everything that we've done here is deterministic outcomes, whether it be eigenvalues or whether it be the deterministic value assignments for the Merman square, everything is sort of deterministic. And so we're missing measurement statistics. And so the idea is, with the simplicial approach, is there some way to incorporate measurement statistics, but in a still topological formulation? So I just want to go take a detour through non-signaling distributions and sort of the generic straightforward approach that people in the physics community basically have been using, right, have been like, okay, I define some sort of scenario. I have some number of inputs, some number of outputs, and then that gives me a set of measurement statistics, which I can encode into like a little box, which gives me the probabilities for each outcome in that context. And then, so the non-signaling distributions are saying that, okay, so we know that Alice and Bob are far away, and so they shouldn't be able to signal. So what you want is that those marginals agree. So the probability of getting A when X zero is performed should not depend on whether Y zero is performed by Bob or Y one is performed by Bob. And so this idea can also be formalized using the idea of sheafs. So just in an informal way, the basic idea of the sheaf approach is the basic construction is that of restriction. So you want things to be downwards compatible. So if you have some distribution x zero, y zero with, you know, one half zero, one half zero, like this one here, you want to make sure that it, when you marginalize to the outcomes of x zero, you get one half, and that this agrees with the other measurement context. So this can be formalized using sheaves. And so there's obviously the work of, this was done by Abramsky and Brandenburger. So what we kind of want to do is merge these two approaches and represent statistics in a sort of topological way. So I'm going to sort of give away the punchline a little bit, where you kind of have edges are going to correspond to single measurements. You're going to have triangles correspond to like a bipartite scenario. And then you can glue these, or actually the triangles will be something like compatible measurements. It doesn't actually have to be a Bell or non-signaling scenario. It could actually just be a non-disturbance scenario as well. And then gluing those triangles together is going to encode the compatibility relationships or non-signaling. So that's the kind of goal. So let's see, how do we work towards that? So just if you start from the topological approach, you might ask like, okay, how can we get to something resembling measurement statistics? So the recipe I want to sort of advocate here is, so in the topological approach, you had these quantum observables A, B, and C, and they have to all be compatible. So A and B commute, and C, we're going to restrict to C being something like the product of the two of them. And in this picture, we have the different faces. So I have one triangle corresponding to the measurement scenario as a whole. And then you can talk about each of the edges labeling quantum observables A, B, and C. So let's be a little bit more precise. So what I want to actually do is assign, if I want to get closer to probabilities, what I actually want to do is assign projectors to the edges and projectors also to the face itself. So by the spectral decomposition, we sort of know that we can break down these observables into projectors. So I'm going to assign a projector over pi AB is going to be the joint outcomes for A and B being measured together. But I can also just look at the measurement outcomes for A itself, B itself, and those are pictured in orange. So the blue triangle is for joint outcomes or joint, so when I perform them together, and then A, so the orange is just what Alice would see or just what Bob would see, for example. And then of course the stand, and then we know how to get probabilities from here through the Born rule, right? So this sort of gives us a map for how we can start to think about statistics and topology together. What we kind of want to do is assign joint measurement statistics to the triangles or the generalized triangles, and then their marginals are going to be face maps on the edges. What I mean, so I'll define what a face map is, but just generally, it's going from one higher dimensional simplex to a lower dimensional one. So this is sort of the flavor of what we want to do. Any questions so far about this?
Okay. I'm a bit confused. You have AB in the middle, then A and B on two of the edges, but then C on the bottom. So there's a kind of weird asymmetry there. What is C?
So C, yeah, I mentioned here, C is going to be the, so you have C, of obvious, it has to be a compatible measurement with A and B, but I'm further restricting to products of A and B. In general, it could be any function, right? But we're just going to look at products. And there's a mathematical reason for this, because essentially, yeah. Yes, Rob?
Oh, wait, why don't you finish answering Lisa's question?
Okay, yeah. So the mathematical reason for this is that essentially the way that this third, so if you look at this picture here, you have A and then B comes right after it. A goes 0 to 1, B goes 1 to 2, and then C goes 0 to 2. If you look at just, it doesn't form a complete cycle. C goes from 0 to 2, and this is a special edge in some sense in the simplicial approach. What you have to do is you can think of A and B as these are elements of a group. There are elements of the unitary group, for example, and C is obtained by composition of the two elements of the group. So if instead of A and B, I had elements of Z2, for example, it would be A and then B, and then the third edge would be the XOR of them, just A plus B, for example. So in some sense, the simplicial approach does sort of restrict what these Cs can be. We need them to be sort of obtained by group composition.
Okay, thanks, that's clear.
Rob?
Yeah, my question is on the next slide,
mm-hmm.
You referred to the map that would get you distributions on the boundary.
The next one?
In terms of, you know, different marginals of the probability distribution that's assigned to the face. But mm-hmm. I mean, all of these probabilities could also be thought of as just arising from the Born rule applied to the projectors that are associated with the boundary, right? Like this.
Yeah, absolutely right. In fact, that's the way that we define a measurement scenario in the quantum setting. In general, I think that the reason that I chose this detour is just to give an element of continuity with the topological approach, where you don't work with the projectors directly. It's more artistic license than anything else. But yeah, you can. In fact, that's the way that we actually do it. Is that you can just go straight for the projectors. You can just assign the projectors to the face and then also to the edges. This is completely accurate as well.
Okay.
Or even you could just go straight for, you could just say that instead of this coming from a scenario where we have quantum measurements at hand, we could just go straight for the probabilities. Somebody gives us a set of statistics and we could just say that I have some probabilities that I'm going to assign to this face such that, and then I can compute also the marginals of that distribution. So we can just go straight for the abstract measurements as well, or the quantum measurements, either or works. So just let's be a little bit more precise. So I want to talk about, so simplicial sets, what are these? So these are sequences of sets. So you could have sets from zero to n and beyond n. It could be an infinite number sort of ladder of sets with face and degeneracy maps. So the face maps, I think we're more comfortable with, it assigns a lower dimensional simplex from a higher dimensional one. So from a triangle to an edge. These degeneracies are a little bit more, they're a little bit harder to understand. They're absolutely crucial if you're a topologist, because what they allow you to do is to define certain kinds of maps that you wouldn't normally. So because simplicial sets, you have an infinite sort of ladder of base of sets. So what the degeneracy does is for every sort of triangle that you have, you can map it into a higher dimensional triangle as well. So every sort of triangle has an image in higher dimensional triangles. This allows you to sort of define different kinds of maps that you wouldn't be able to. And so from a topology point of view, it's very nice because you're dealing with these abstract simplicial sets. One thing that you might want is, okay, what does the geometric realization look like? So the abstract simplicial set of an edge is just a list, a set, 0, 1, strictly ordered, right? And then the geometrical realization of this is a line. So you might want, for example, to think about, what if I multiply two simplicial sets with each other? So 0, 1 times 0, 1. What you would like in principle is for the geometric realization of these two simplicial sets to look something like a square or a disk or some sort of, you know, bounded plane. If you work with simplicial complexes, this is not the case. Simplicial sets have this property that if you take the abstract simplicial sets, you multiply them, you get a geometric realization that's like the product of the the product of the realizations is topologically the same as the realization of the product, which is a nice property. So I'll talk more about the degeneracies later, but it is true that they're a little bit harder to explain and they're less intuitive, I would claim. So the way that that physics enters here is that we're going to sort of follow the topological prescription where we take edges and we interpret them as measurements. N simplices are going to be measurement contexts. And then the gluing of those simplices are going to encode the non-signaling or non-disturbance conditions. So just the face maps of a triangle. So I'm going to restrict mainly to just triangles. There will be some other generalized simplices later, but just it's easier to picture. Here I just have the face maps. So you go from a 2-simplex to a 1-simplex. And so there's different face maps. So D2, for example, is going to give me the edge that's opposite of the second vertex. I have the vertices labeled. And then if I go to this 1-simplex σ01 that I have pictured here, then the D0 face is going to give me σ1 because that's the opposite end of that's the vertex opposite of zero, so on and so forth. We also want to define a space of outcomes. So this is also going to be represented by a simplicial set, where the nth simplices are going to be like n-dimensional outcomes. So we work with something called a nerve space. Essentially what that is so the nerve of Z mod D, what it basically is n tuples of outcomes in ZD. So here I have pictured, for example, The zero with simplex is just a single point. It doesn't have a value associated with it, but the one simplices are zero and one because these are the possible outcomes in Z mod two. And then if you go to the two simplices of this space, then you get possible two double tuples. So 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. And when you go, so this is piggybacking on the remark I made earlier about the quantum observables. If I pick A to have value on one of the edges, so, or rather the more proper way is, if I assign AB as a tuple to this triangle, what are the marginals? Okay, well, the marginal to the one edge is going to be A. The way that this works is that the face map D2, in this case, is going to get rid of the B. It just deletes it. The face map is like a delete operation, by the way. And then the degeneracy maps, you can think of as something like a copy operation. Face deletes, degeneracy copies. That's the sort of like heuristic that you can follow. So when you have these outcomes, D2 will delete the B outcome and give me A on this face, B on this other one. And then, like I was saying before, the third edge is going to be the group composition of the two. And if I go to higher simplices, then I'm always composing elements that are adjacent to each other. So if I had a triple, maybe I should have pictured it here, A1 or ABC, then I would have like A and B being summed for one of the edges, B and C being summed for another one of the edges, et cetera. But it doesn't have to just be Z mod D. You can actually have other outcome spaces. You can have this circle, and the circle has one generating simplex, one simplex. So what do I mean by that? It's the only one that's not coming from a degeneracy. Degeneracy maps just copy things. So usually we want to restrict ourselves to these generating simplices. And so here we just, what is a circle? It's a one simplex that has the two vertices identified with each other, sigma one equals sigma zero. And so you have, in general, that's the non-degenerate simplex, but then you can also have these degenerate simplices, which are just obtained by copying one of the elements. So here, if I start with 0, 1, I can copy the one, I can copy the zero. Sorry, I'm looking over here. I can copy the one, I can copy the zero, or I can copy the ones that are in this degenerate one simplex here. And in general, what's nice about this simplicial circle, other than just being a nice instructive example where you can see degeneracies show up, is that you always have precisely n plus one outcomes. So if you want to define something like a POVM, which is going to be something like a map from a set of outcomes to a set of projectors, it's nice to have a sort of outcome space that has precisely, you know exactly, it's got n plus one outcomes. So I can just define a POVM on that number of outcomes that don't necessarily come from something like Z mod D. Okay, where are the distributions coming? If Y is some outcome space, usually I have in mind Z2, then the n simplices of the space of distributions are precisely those maps from the n simplices of Y to the non-negative numbers. So for example, if I have this two simplex and I want to map it to the two simplices of Z mod two, I have four possible maps and I assign a weighting to each of those, such that it's a distribution, non-negative and sums to one. Yeah, so in particular, if I look at that example again, because it's going to play a role in improving Fine's theorem, you can look at, okay, so what are the face maps of, so if I take P00, P01, P10, P11, this is a element of a two simplex in the space of distributions. So what are the face maps here? Well, you can actually, you can compute the face maps and you get that the face map D2 acting on this distribution gives me the sum of two numbers. And then, so maybe I did this the opposite direction, yes. So if I start with I equals zero, I get actually this end. And then I get basically the marginals here. That's what the face maps end up being. And in the case of NZ2, there's a nice property that the marginals determine the distribution exactly, because here you have three parameters, but there is normalization. So the marginals on these three edges suffice to actually determine everything exactly, which is nice. Okay, so just to give some language to what we're talking about, a simplicial scenario is just a measurement space X, for example, like a triangle or a torus or this weird space down here. That's our measurement space. And then Y is going to be something like, is going to be our outcome space. And then a simplicial distribution is just a set of maps from the measurement space to distributions on the outcomes. So for every two simplex, I assign a distribution. For every one simplex, three simplex, so on and so forth. And then we're going to denote these simplicial distributions, the set of them, by S of XY. For example, okay, the CHS stage scenario. This is fun. So there's a few different ways that you can actually represent it. So, and each of them are going to actually, maybe not each of them, at least two of them will have different sort of functions as giving proof techniques for Fine's theorem. So one of them is a CHSH scenario is a punctured torus. So what you have here is you have the Y edge, the X, so X0, Y0. So you have all the same context that you have that you're familiar with. Y0, X0, Y0, X1, X0, Y1, X1, Y1. And so what the simplicial distribution does is it assigns a distribution to each of these triangles. And you have to have, because of these identifying relations, which is just where you glue the triangles, you have to have these compatibility relationships. So the distributions have to satisfy the same compatibility relationships as the space itself. So these are precisely where you get the non-signaling conditions coming in. And so one of the things that's nice about having this extra edge that's not necessarily intuitive, this extra XOR where you're adding the two variables together, is that there's sort of more options for how you can represent this space. So one is as this punctured torus. So it's a torus, the edges are identified, but then there's this big white hole in the middle. But you can also realize it as a square. This can also be used for a proof of Fine's theorem, or even a cylinder, actually. And I think that it's an advantage that you can represent them in more than one way. So this actually, the sheaf theoretic approach can actually be embedded in this. For example, the normal way that you would describe a geometric way of describing the CHSH scenario in the sheaf theoretic approach is by the boundary of a square. Where each of the nodes is a measurement. And so basically it's a dimension shift, right? So here you have a one simplex as being a bipartite scenario, and then so the zero simplices are single measurements. Here we have basically one dimension up. In fact, this scenario here, this square, is a cone of this other one. So that's kind of a neat way to look at it. Basically, just put a little point above this square and then fill up the sides, and that's the same thing as this space on the side here. Okay, so of course, if you want to talk about contextuality, I don't want to go too much into it, we can, but the idea is that you want to assign outcomes. So you can assign an outcome from a space to a set of measurements, and that corresponds roughly to some deterministic distributions, right? So if there's some pre-existing values for your measurement, then these outcome assignments can be mapped into deterministic distributions, and the space of those is D of X, Y. And then the space of classical distributions is just, we're taking the straightforward sort of interpretation of classical distributions as convex mixtures of the deterministic ones.
Can I just ask, the different ways that you found topological forms for the CHZ scenario as a cylinder, as a punctured torus, as this kind of, are these like, is the shape somehow indicative of contextuality itself?
So it can be. So we're working on it. There are some hints that it is important. For example, there's a theorem in the sheaf theoretic approach that says that a scenario is contextual if and only, or sorry, it's non-contextual. Easier, the theorem by Voroboyev is that it's non-contextual if and only if it's got like it's an acyclic sort of simplicial complex, something to that effect. I may have jumbled it up a little, but here you have that our scenario is precisely a cone of that one. So this boundary, which is important, this cycle here that's important in the sheaf approach, will also be important for us, because this boundary is precisely what captures the the boundary is precisely what determines the value of the CHSH function, you know, like expectation plus 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 minus. It's completely characterized by this boundary. So if you look at all of the different spaces, they have the same boundary. This one, it's all with these XOR measurements. This one as well with the XOR measurements, and then this one as well, because this is a cylinder, X0 and X0 are identified. The boundaries are always the same. So in this case, yeah, there's a very neat relationship between the topology, in particular that you have a certain kind of boundary. Now, it's the case that not every boundary gives you contextuality, right? Because the two simplex also has a boundary. So it's something that's part of ongoing work, yeah, but we definitely think that there are cases where, yes, the topology is playing an important role in the contextuality. On the other hand, you did point, you know, you put salt in the wound, because the hope was originally that the topology itself would almost always, or something like this, be a leading indicator of contextuality. And it seems that's not immediately obvious. More work needs to be done. So to define contextuality, we want to talk about a map going from the set of classical distributions to simplicial distributions. And basically, this, you can think of this as something like marginalization, but it could be more general than this. But basically, you're taking a classical distribution, which is like a joint distribution over all the possible outcomes, and you're mapping it into the simplicial distribution. So what is contextuality? A simplicial distribution is called non-contextual if P is in the image of theta. That means you can marginalize the joint distribution to get the P. Otherwise, it's called contextual. So by definition, the n-simplex is always non-contextual, for example. And so what I have pictured here is just, I have the weightings, and then in the purple are the deterministic outcomes, just pictured in a sort of pictorial way. The CHSH scenario we know is contextual. You can't write it as just a convex mixture of these deterministic outcomes. So the PR box we know is a counterexample. You can also have these sort of interesting other examples, like a cone. If you take a single triangle and glue it along one of the two of the edges, sorry, so Y and Y here, you get a cone, or that is, you identify these two blue dots with each other. And this is contextual, actually. And we want to claim that this is the first, this is the N equals one cycle scenario. People know that the CHSH is the N equals four cycle scenario. So this is the N equals one cycle scenario. No, I don't think that there is any sort of quantum realization of this, but it's kind of indicative of the sort of different sorts of scenarios that you might be able to come up with. I think mathematicians are interested in this, and they're like, Salman, can you find an interpretation? That's not usually how it works. You should really be looking at good physics and then seeing if you can model that in terms of a good simplicial scenario. But it might be interesting to sort of work backwards every now and again to see if these weird scenarios have any sort of actual realizations. Okay, this is another one that actually, and I promise I won't take too much more time. I realize that we're close to the end. So the torus, so this is like the torus that we introduced before, but all the betas are zero, essentially, is the difference. So this is another scenario that you can define, and it's always non-contextual. This is a result that we proved recently. The boundary of a three simplex is always non-contextual, and we'll use this result momentarily. You can glue distributions together. If you do glue two non-contextual distributions along a simplex, then the result is also a non-contextual distribution. That's what the gluing lemma says. So we will use this for Fine's theorem. So Fine's theorem is that a distribution on the CHSH scenario is non-contextual if and only if that distribution restricted to the boundary. So the restriction to the, satisfies the CHSH inequalities. So these are written in terms of those funny third edges that are not intuitive, but those have a precise physical meaning in terms of expectation values. If you just use the definition of the expectation or the correlation, then you find that these PXI plus YJ is precisely related, linearly related to these. So you can just rewrite the CHSH inequalities in terms of these probabilities that are on the boundary. So here's just in a couple of steps, I want to go through Fine's theorem. So if you have a distribution that's on the boundary of what I call a diamond, if it's on the boundary of a diamond, it extends to the bulk of the diamond if and only if CHSH-like inequalities are satisfied. So I say CHSH-like, just it's the same functional form, but it's determined in terms of precisely these marginals that are on the boundary of this diamond. So it extends if and only if these CHSH-like inequalities hold. Second step, I have a boundary of a three simplex, which I claimed was non-contextual, and hopefully you believe me. It's in the paper. So if I, by the gluing lemma, if I glue these two together along a two simplex, which is what I poorly drew here, then I have another non-contextual scenario, which I'm going to call H. So how does this help us? So if I take my original CHSH scenario, which I'm going to depict for our current purposes as a square, and in the next step, I'm just going to draw it with a little bit of an angle. It's the same exact thing. I just want to use this vantage point to point out that it's going to be very related to, it's basically the top portion of this space H. Next, I want to notice that there's this this one-dimensional space boundary of what I called boundary of A that's included in Q. How is it included? It's this blue line. It's this blue boundary of a diamond. It's the green boundary of a diamond and the red boundary of a diamond that goes all the way around. And there's the fact that this boundary of A, what I called boundary of A, extends to A if and only if the CHSH inequalities for this green, this blue, and this red are satisfied. So by the way, what I should have mentioned before, this is a statement that's if and only if, right? So it means that at the same time, if I have a diamond that's filled, then that means that any distribution on its boundary satisfies CHSH. So that's something to remember. It goes both ways. I can fill it if it has CHSH, or if it's filled, then it satisfies CHSH. So when you look at this picture here, you see that I have these two diamonds here. This is the blue one, and this is the green one. And so those two CHSH inequalities are already satisfied by definition of my scenario. This always holds. And so essentially, the Fine's theorem comes down to saying, if I require that the red boundary here also satisfies CHSH, then I can extend to this space A, and then I can also extend all the way to this space H, which I said was non-contextual. So a distribution P on Q that satisfies CHSH inequalities extends to this space. And so we have a lemma somewhere else that if this sort of property holds, then it must be that P was itself non-contextual. So that's kind of the game. There's an alternative proof of Fine's theorem, which is just using two facts. This torus is non-contextual, and you extend from this punctured torus to the torus if and only if you have the CHSH inequalities. Therefore, it must be that P is non-contextual. So this is in a recent paper that we did. Okay, and so I swear that I'm done. 1 minute. If you want to do quantum simplicial scenarios, like we mentioned with Rob earlier, was that you map simplices to projectors instead, and the space of projective measurements is a map from each simplex to a set of projectors on the Hilbert space. You can also do it for POVMs, just easier to write for projectors. And by composing with the simplicial Born rule, we can actually just, by simplicial Born rule, I just mean that you define the map in the simplicial setting, but the Born rule is still just trace of quantum state with the projector. And so you can go from the measurement space to projectors to probabilities, and then you can use the same notion of contextuality that we had before. So you can determine whether it's, you know, violates some Bell inequalities or not. Just to bring everything full circle, you can also recover the cohomological witness of state-independent, state-dependent contextuality and refine those results to capture strong contextuality as well. If you have, instead of eigenvalues, if you look at a subspace with, for example, this is, for example, deterministic distributions along the edges, then you can use cohomology to capture strong contextuality as well. And sorry for going over, and thank you for listening.
Salman, why you can choose who to accept questions for. There's hands in the Zoom.
Looks TC Frazier. I guess raise their hand a second.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Hi. Sure. Yeah, my name is TC. Thank you for the talk. That was very interesting. Yeah, I've been wanting to learn more about this kind of sheaf theoretic homological approaches to things. So I especially find it helpful, this definition of simplicial distributions. Like, I think it's really, you know, it's really elegant and a useful tool. You mentioned in response to one of Ellie's questions, this conception about like, you know, there's this, you know, a priori hope or desire in some sense that maybe contextuality is somehow captured by some topological data. Like it's just, you know, you can just read off it. You don't need to consider any more complicated stuff. But so how does this stuff relate to some of the check cohomology that arises from the sheaf theoretic approach? And in particular, there's some statements about the existence of a non-trivial cohomology class is necessary and sufficient to conclude contextuality, provided this sort of simplicial scenario is acyclic. When you have that kind of well-behaved topological property, then you can conclude that there is a strong link between cohomology and contextuality. Is that fit? Like, because it seems like what you're doing here is already going beyond that. And I'm just wondering whether or not some of those insights
are maintained. There was a lag. If I remember correctly, the cohomological approach that they use, there's a theorem that they basically adopt from Voroboyev from like the 50s or 60s, which is that if you have this sort of acyclic property, then it's non-contextual. That's right. And then they have a general statement that their cohomology captures strong contextuality, but it's not if and only if, right? There's like false positives and there's some defects, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, the approach introduces false positives, but I thought that maybe I'm just misremembering because it has been a while, but the idea was that by considering higher and higher order cohomology classes that you would eliminate those false positives. I don't know if they actually resolve that, but I thought maybe, yeah, if you consider like the nth order or the first order obstructions, then you can introduce false positives and that maybe you eliminate.
I'm not aware if there was a resolution. We had somebody at Sidney Montananjo, who was from Campinas in Sao Paulo, and he was working on sort of fixing this false positive problem. And so this was earlier this year. So he had told me that it was not fixed. And so he was going about it by, I guess, changing the cohomology to go from rings to semi-rings or something like this, because the false positives were coming from some way that the chain complex was defined. So I don't remember to answer your question. I don't know if it was resolved. I'm not aware, but Sydney made it seem like it wasn't resolved. So,
okay, no, that's great. It's been a while since, so that's good that I know where to look. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I could ask the next question if nobody in line. Thanks for the presentation. And I wanted to ask about where you see the simplicial framework possibly giving us something, a new kind of proof of quantum contextuality. So I think often with these different frameworks, the hope is that by, you know, looking at things in this new way, you might be able to leverage some mathematical results from that area. So like, as TC was saying, you know, results from cohomology theory, for example, or like powerful theorems in some branch of mathematics that weren't obviously relevant before to contextuality, but now their relevance becomes apparent. And I totally understand that, you know, when one develops a new framework, you start by trying to reproduce the things that we know to kind of sort of see how the framework treats common topics. But I guess my question is like, where do you see perhaps this framework giving us something that, you know, we didn't already know, like not just a new proof of old results, but, you know, something that we couldn't easily have come across if we'd been thinking in the other frameworks?
Yeah, so I think that we're still working on new proof techniques. But I mean, I think that, for example, the topology does sort of give you additional leverage for finding new proof techniques. There's two ways of proving Fine's theorem. So my colleague Aziz has a way, so they just put out a paper where they are able to capture vertices of polytopes through homotopies. So, I mean, the construction's a little bit elaborate, so, and it's not obvious to me that they're capturing vertices that can't be captured by standard methods, but yeah, like, it's a work in progress. I understand what you're asking, and I think that we are hoping that that's the case because it is more general. We're hoping that it can sort of accommodate some, yeah, unearth some things that maybe using algebraic topology that was not maybe obvious before. We're still in that phase. It's a relatively recent work. So yeah, but I share your sentiment actually that it's like, okay, but to what end? And like, are you actually, if I'm being honest, right? So for example, the scenarios, you get new kinds of scenarios. It's not obvious that those scenarios are at all realistic, right? So it's, yes, you get more, but is that more useful at all is a good question. And it's, hopefully it will be, yeah, I'm optimistic.
And do you think in particular that it will, like on this final slide, you mentioned measurement-based quantum computing. Are you particularly focused on sort of understanding contextuality as a resource for quantum computing through this framework?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely one of the focuses. Yeah, we're currently, so a couple of different things that we're focusing on, but one of them is adapting. So Robert Rausendorf has this cohomological approach to MBQC, but it's not at all, it captures the topology, but it's for this case where it's non-adaptive MBQC. And so we're certainly like working on this. We believe that the simplicial framework, because it allows for the statistics, first of all, it generalizes that version, his version of MBQC right off the bat, but it can also accommodate for causal structure as well. I know that there's been some recent work with like causal structure in the sheaf approach. Nicola Pinzani, I spoke with him. For example, and him and Stefano have a couple of papers out. And so we think that also we can accommodate this just by virtue of it being able to accommodate whatever the sheaf approach does. That is definitely something that we're interested in, connecting to contextuality as a resource for computation. That's one of the directions that we're looking in. To just go back for a second to your original question, which I think is actually the one of the more valid ones, is just, what does this buy you? There's a couple of things. For example, this gluing lemma, I've given it to you in a sort of like simplified form. This is actually a corollary. So it tells you when you can glue two distributions together to get another, so two non-contextual distributions to get another one. We don't fully understand this lemma yet, but in its full glory, it sort of gives these conditions that, so the conditions are roughly that, say you glue two scenarios along a particular space, then it's if each of the component pieces is non-contextual and you glue along this intersection, it also gives you the condition for the composite to be non-contextual. And perhaps that would be useful in actually determining some Bell inequalities. Maybe it simplifies some of the calculations to determine necessary and sufficient conditions for when two distributions, so for when that scenario is non-contextual. That's one area that we're looking at. Another thing that I did not touch on here that might be useful as well, like I said, there's a lot of toys to play with here. One is that when you come from the simplicial point of view, actually there's a notion of actually acting groups, of acting distributions upon each other. They actually form a monoid, is what it's called. Basically, the deterministic distributions are like group elements. They're invertible, and you can act on it. If you act a deterministic distribution on a distribution itself, it's sort of, it maps to another distribution, and there's a well-defined sense in which you can do this. And it's not just a group, it's also this thing called a monoid, which is like a group without inverses. And so I think also maybe it could take advantage of this to get some, maybe simplify certain problems. Of course, people use symmetries in these problems all the time. So I'm not claiming that it's going to be the end all be all, but I think that there is some structure here that eventually will be useful.
Okay, thanks.
TC?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if somebody else had a question, but yeah, you regarding this gluing lemma, like I think this is an extremely helpful insight in a lot of these kinds of like chief theoretic, you know, local versus global compatibility problems. The thing that you run into is like, to what is it okay that if you know two pieces of data agree on where they overlap, then you can't always stitch them together. It seems like this gluing lemma is just the natural generalization of the sort of adhesivity or gluing lemmas for probability distributions. This is just a generalization of that insight for
these simplicial distributions. Yeah, by the way, the insight comes from Fine's theorem, right? So Fine's theorem, essentially, the original paper is just about stitching together probability distributions. And then we were like, okay, but actually we can do this. And it's for general outcome spaces, and it's much far more general than what Fine originally did. So I am optimistic that there is some more juice that we still haven't appreciated in the structure here. Thank you.
Maybe I'd just jump in and say I think a really useful keyword for you to use at this point is that, you know, the Fine's theorem is ultimately about the classical marginals problem.
Mm-hmm.
And your gluing lemma is about the classical marginals problem.
So,
you know, people study the classical marginals problem without knowing anything about Fine's theorem. It's just like, it's where the classical marginal problem happens to show up in the literature on non-locality first is in Fine's work. But I think since then, you know, people have recognized the full extent to which the classical marginal problem is pertinent to non-contextuality and locality, and it goes beyond what's in Fine's paper.
Yeah. I will just say that I think a lot of those insights, which are primarily about just vanilla probability distributions, it's nice to see that these more general simplicial distributions share all those features that, you know what I mean? It's you haven't lost this composability property.
So I just had a question. Do you have any specific references that you had in mind? I'm aware of the marginal problem more broadly, but I don't know if there's some sort of more far-reaching sort of reference, maybe a survey of such problems. I would be open to seeing what that's about as well.
PC, maybe you could suggest, I know Tobias Fritz has some nice papers on the pertinence of the classical marginal problem.
I believe that paper.
I'll say that this idea of like a Bramsky's work on sheaf theoretic way of articulating these problems, it's already, you know, headed in the right direction. I think, you know, these like promoting the status of the topological aspects of the problem.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
No, I mean, but the sheaf theoretic approach is, so I didn't give it its due justice. It is also topological, right? It's built on simplicial complexes. So, and while that's not immediate from the first, I mean, it wasn't immediate to me in the first paper, but they do other papers where they have to define like morphisms and other sort of more general measurement protocols. And they're using the simplicial maps like all the time. So it is true that it is topological. And like you said, this Voroboyev theorem is also topological. So it's not like that's lacking topology.
With regards to what this all, like comparing quantum versus classical models, I think focusing in on like the failure of, you know, the gluing lemmas when you have quantum data assigned to these topological objects is coming to be more clear that this plays an important role.
Absolutely.
I just had a quick question about one of the slides. Could you go back to like that one cycle where you turned a triangle into a cone? And you said like there's an example of contextuality on that?
Yes, absolutely. One second. This one, yes.
So the bottom of that slide, it looks to me like what you've written is an equality, not an inequality. Is it because of the thing in the middle? Like what's?
I'm not sure. It's supposed to be not equals.
Yeah, that would be the inability to decompose it. But how is it not equal to that?
It's not obvious from this, is it? Okay, sorry. You're absolutely right. It's not equal to this because if you write the immediate the distribution corresponding to 0, 0, 0 and 0, 1, 1, you find that the 1/2s are going to be, for example, the 0, 0, 0, 1. This is a deterministic outcome where all the measurements Alice and Bob have get outcome 0. That means that there is a probability 1 straight in the middle, P0, 0. Right?
Yep.
Okay, so that's how to interpret this box. And so because there's something non-zero here, if you look at the left-hand side, there's a zero here. So in general, there's only 3 vertices in this scenario in the corresponding polytope. One is this, and the others are these 2 deterministic distributions. And so that's where this is coming from, essentially. There's just 2 of them. And if you just take the most obvious convex combination, it can't give you this.
And the problem is because of the 0 in the middle.
I mean, yeah, you can't get it from, just in the standard definition, you can't get it from a convex sum of, exactly, you're... this other one, by the way, will give you a 1 precisely, let's see, it will give you a 1 precisely in the other 0, if I'm not mistaken. Let me think. If I have a 0, so that's the 0 outcome, this is the 1 outcome, and this is 1. This one, 0, 1, okay, yeah, the 0, 1 is going to give me the 0, 1 probability. A 1 at the 0, 1 location, which is right here. So both of these will give me 2 ones or 1/2s precisely where these zeros are. So that's why it's contextual.
All right. Would it be fair to say that the conclusion does not follow from any information on the boundary?
That it does not follow from any... Actually, no, it does follow from the information on the boundary in this case, because it is, so with all these cycle scenarios, basically everything, whether it be the sheaf or the simplicial approach, everything is contained by the fact that you have a cycle on this boundary. So here, the fact that we have this being a cone with this loop here, that's what's causing the contextuality. Yeah. Same for the CHSH. Not in this representation. It's still, you can see it here. There's this boundary here. But if you do any of these, in fact, many of the scenarios we've looked at, there's always this loop, but we haven't been able to prove rigorously that you always have something like this.
Okay. Okay. And your choice of like matrix multiplication or addition mod 2 for outcomes is because you need this to sort of be a monoid. You need to have composition for whatever
things. Yeah, so it's generally if you work with the nerve as your outcome space, or generally whenever you're working as the nerve, in fact, when we work with those observables that you multiply together, you're working with a nerve over like the unitary group. So the way that it works is precisely that these nerve spaces have that property that you have to multiply on this third edge. You have to use the group composition property. Now, it's possible that you have other spaces like this simplicial circle where that's not the interpretation per se of this third edge. It's more flexible, but I think that the nerve space is just the one that we use most often, which is why you often have this property of either adding or multiplying in this way.
Okay. Other questions? Let's thank the speaker. Thank you, Salman. That was really fascinating.
Thanks.